So I'm glad to welcome myself and Stuart Goodnick tonight to Many Rivers Books and Tea to talk about the subject of intelligence, consciousness, and slack. So I'm the one who came up with the title, and it all refers to stuff I've been reading, reflecting on, and working with over the last few months. So the intelligence part comes from especially the second book, but this Israeli historian, Yuval Noah Harari, has published his second book just a few months ago. The second book is Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. He preceded it a few years back with Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Both are definitely worth reading. The discussion of intelligence and consciousness partly stems from that second one, Homo Deus, the recent one, because Harari talks about consciousness as well as intelligence. I don't entirely agree with what he has to say, but it is nevertheless very stimulating what he has to say. And the slack term comes from an upcoming book to be published. Stuart and I are editing a book of our teacher, Robert Daniel Ennis's writings, talks, transcribed talks, etc. And one of my, so far as I've been going through the material again, my favorite piece is called Slack, or Slack 101. Even though it came out of it was a talk that he gave as part that was entitled originally Enlightenment 101. He during the course of this fairly long talk ends up talking about this concept of slack. So we'll get into that as we proceed. So welcome, Stuart.
Thank you.
The intersection of intelligence and consciousness is interesting, as propounded by Mr. Harari in his book Homo Deus, because he essentially acknowledges that, which a lot of contemporary writers do not, that all our attempts to understand consciousness from an intellectual perspective have been essentially fruitless. That is, to have a grand theory of consciousness, or even not so grand theory of consciousness, has not worked out well. We don't really understand what consciousness is. We can't define it. We can, to some extent, describe it, but even those descriptions are generate much disagreement. And so, so most of his book is actually describing intelligence, which he interestingly reduces to the concept of algorithm. And an algorithm is, of course, a process or a procedure by which problems can be solved or addressed, I guess. And so I'll have more to say about that as we go on, but that's kind of a starting point for our discussion tonight. I'm sort of reporting on my own investigation of these topics as it is ongoing, and it's not meant to be a final. I'm not going to define consciousness tonight, and nor do I think it's even a fruitful thing to pursue. On the other hand, I will outline some proposals from another book, and I put that book out here on the table here too. This book is Pristine Affluence, Taoist Roots in the Stone Age, by famous Taoist scholar Lydia Cohn. And her basic thesis
which is appealing to me as an archaeologist of the Mesolithic, is that the Taoist spiritual slash religious philosophy actually is looking backward from 2,500 or 2,000 years ago. It's looking backward to the period of the Mesolithic and early Neolithic Stone Age peoples in China, and essentially arguing that that's what the Taoists wanted to recapitulate, wanted to regain the lifestyle, the consciousness, actually, of the people living at that time. And just for those not versed in Mesolithic and Neolithic archaeology, which would probably be most everyone in the room but myself and Stuart, except what he's picked up along the way, listening to me blather on, is this idea of egalitarian hunter-gatherers. And then even in the Neolithic, which is defined as the early period of farming, you still have a lot of reliance upon hunting and gathering for subsistence. And this quality of egalitarian lifestyle is in the Taoist view, as propounded in this book, Pristine Affluence. By the way, the name Pristine Affluence comes from a very famous book by an anthropologist named Marshall Solins, who wrote of this thing called Pristine Affluence among hunter-gatherers that he and other anthropologists were studying in the 1960s. And he was arguing that these folks in hunter-gatherer contexts, even though they were marginal biomes for hunter-gatherer lifestyle compared with the ones that were taken over by farmers thousands of years before, nevertheless, his argument is that these people were able to subsist and live comfortably working far fewer hours per day than subsequent peoples, including later Neolithic and all subsequent cultures, definitely including our own, especially when I watch Stuart.
Yeah, we're the heavy work.
So 3 or 4 hours a day, or sometimes you see 4 to 6 hours, so that 4 or 5 hours a day, something like that. But work broken up by play, by singing, by poetry, by whatever they happen to, taking a nap, whatever they wanted to do, right? So this is also relatable to the Taoist perspective, and the reason for Dr. Kohn to use the phrase pristine affluence, because the Taoists, then, she's proposing, are retrospectively looking back, whether they realized it or not. They wouldn't have had an idea of Mesolithic, Neolithic that we do, but they did have very clear ideas about how people could live differently, which are very congruent with our understanding of Mesolithic, Neolithic, early Neolithic peoples. Yeah.
I've been thinking about your observations on this. So Lao Tzu was about 2,500 years ago, and he has a very brief description of the ideal village.
Right.
And Chuang Tzu was about 2,000 years ago, and he has some more fleshed out observations. The question I'm asking is, do you think they simply inherited this description, or were there still communities around at that time that would have instead kept on to that way of life? I mean, would they have been able to wander off somewhere and actually observe that, or was it already mythic?
It's a fabulous question, and I think it requires a lot more research. That is one of the reasons why I've invited Livia Cohn to be on our radio show, so I can ask her about some of that. I mean, there's not we would have to go back to whatever evidence that exists. I mean, that being said, I haven't yet addressed this particular issue, but Livia Cohn suggests that there are four stages of human consciousness, which we today have access to but tend not to use, three of the four, but that the Taoists argue that we should eschew, put aside for the most part, if not entirely, the final stage of consciousness. I'll get to that, and then go back to earlier stages of consciousness. And it is conceivable to me that some of the, it's absolutely conceivable, even it would follow from some of the arguments in her book and other anthropological research I know, that would suggest that even as late as the 20th century, people, even in Europe, there were groups even in Europe that would not have partaken of the analytical good-bad mind, which is this fourth stage that she talks about, where these earlier aspects of human consciousness would have prevailed for the most part. So, complicated, huh? But once you start to look at it, it's actually not that complicated. I mean, I don't want to get into all the details of these four stages, although you could argue that the first stage is something like is what our hominin ancestors would have experienced, much like animals today. Jim was telling us this great story. Perhaps you might recapitulate it for us about the raven in Fairbanks.
Actually, on the North Coast.
On the North Slope of Alaska. Sorry.
So I was working on the North Coast of Alaska, and one winter I observed the following: that a workman at the construction site, I was in a trailer at the time, was eating cookies from a bag as he was walking away, and he dropped two cookies on the ground. He walks away, and pretty soon after that, a raven flies down and looks at one cookie and picks it up in his beak. Then he tilts his head and he sees the other cookie, so he drops the first one and hops over to the second one, you know, picks that one up, and then he tilts his head again and goes back to the first one. And then this is what fascinates me about this. Then he hunkers down and he goes, you know, he looks at one and he looks at the other and he's going. And then he picks up the first one, he places it on top of the second, puts his beak around both of them, and flies away.
Right.
So don't underestimate the raven.
And don't underestimate our early hominin ancestors, because I think that the argument that Livia Cohn makes, and that I would certainly agree with, is that's a type of consciousness, that's a phase of consciousness that we have access to. We might even say that there's an aspect of our own nature in these bodies that we have, that recapitulates that, and we may even have experience of that during our own development. So the old recapitulation argument, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is ontogeny is the development of an individual, phylogeny is the development of a species or group of individuals, that the one thing recapitulates the other. Now that's been contested with regard to, say, embryos and, you know, fetuses and that sort of thing, and the development, like, of humans. There's been arguments advanced to contest that, but cognitively, apparently, that idea is still current with evolutionary psychologists and others. So the argument is then that we have the capacity to act like the raven whether we have a discriminative mind or not, whether we have the middle two stages. One of the interesting things about this Livia Cohn book is this is a hypothesis that I've only just briefly touched on before and sort of I let it go, but she talks about it more concretely and has a lot of references which are useful if I'll be able to follow up, which is the idea that the stage of consciousness that most human adults on the planet occupy today, and certainly those of us in this room, I can testify because I know pretty to some extent everyone here, is that stage that Livia Cohn and the sources she's drawing upon argue arose only with literacy. So the self-reflexive analytical mind that discriminates good and bad arose with not just narrowly held priestly literacy, as happened in Sumeria and Babylon, 5,000 years ago, but we're talking about more like 3,000 years ago, when there began, the Greek alphabet became available to Greek speakers. It was developed and became available and was quickly used by Greek speakers. I was telling people the other day that I just read this article just like a few weeks ago about this site in northern Greece where there are these drinking vessels, ritual drinking vessels, wine, of course, wine drinking vessels that were discovered at this site in northern Greece dating to between 700 and 800 BC. Where we see these little inscriptions written in this early Greek alphabet that are quite clearly not of a priestly nature. They are there's stuff like, "This is my wine cup, and if you steal it and drink from it, you'll die," or stuff, or you'll be poisoned, or stuff like that. I mean, it's this individual kind of stuff. That was not available before for people to express in a context of writing. So she argues that she's arguing that this discriminative mind that we take for granted as the human mind, the capacity to make good and bad distinctions, yes and no, etc., developed in that context where literacy appeared. And before that, there would have been a form of human consciousness that could express like and dislike, like a baby likes it if you maybe tickle the baby or something like that, or give it food, or if you do something that it doesn't like pull it away from, you're holding it and you pull it away from something it wants to grab, but that's different than the analytical mind of good and bad. So that's part of this thesis. So then, the Taoist project, as described by Dr. Cohn, is to recapture the ability to experience these earlier states of consciousness, including the earliest one, which would be where spirit is mind. That the Taoists describe it as spirit is mind. There's no distinction between your spirit and my spirit. In fact, for me to say your spirit, my spirit, is not part of the lexicon that they would use. That would be stage two, I think, where discrimination can occur, but we don't have the sort of mental projections that in stage four start to become possible. So mental projections onto other people, onto other things, only become possible with stage four, this stage four consciousness.
I have a question about that, because it seems mm-hmm. it seems as though you could make a similar argument that the arising of language and spoken language would effect a similar kind of class abstraction and reaction to abstract classes and labeling of abstract mm-hmm. classes as good and bad. And
I think it's fair to say that the potential is there. Orality is, in fact, one of those. I can't remember if it's the second or third stage off the top of my head, but orality is defined as one of those stages, in fact. But it, but the point she makes and her sources make is that that leap to abstraction does not happen necessarily just with the existence of language. So people don't use language in that way until you get to this literacy stage where you have a self, where you can create a self-reflective self that considers its relationship to the world in this abstract way, and that literacy is what promotes that. You don't have to agree with the argument,
right? I mean, I get it. I guess it did. I have a hard time seeing how you couldn't make the same argument about just the arising of language itself.
Okay. Well, you have to look at the anthropology. The reason that it's not just abstraction is that you have to look at the anthropology of how groups actually use language, mm-hmm. and that's where she draws on evidence to make the distinction between these faculties. So in fact, you know, I mentioned even the 20th century. There, I haven't looked at the research myself, but apparently there was anthropological research in, I want to say, Crimea or just southern Russia, of some groups that apparently weren't using language in this to create abstractions in quite the same way that she's pointing to with the advent of literacy, when there's still an oral culture,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a distinction between a purely oral culture and a culture with written, the written resource becomes a way to that the human mind restructures itself in order to have this facility with abstraction.
Question.
Yeah.
How about a pre-oral culture? What stage of consciousness was that?
Well, that would be the first one, which would be spirit, where essentially it's like animals.
So you want to impart knowledge to a baby. How are you doing that as a human?
Well, remember that we may not be thinking like that. We're not thinking because we don't have, before we have words, we're not thinking, I want to impart knowledge to a baby, or I want the baby to do this. We are just acting from instinct. And the baby, acting from instinct, picks up what is available through example and through instinct. And at the same time, of course, you have the elaboration of culture, which we now are beginning to see that culture is shared by other species. You know, there are groups of monkeys that have one way of addressing their material culture needs, and other groups of the same species elsewhere that have other cultural habits of addressing their material culture needs.
So do the Taoists want to get back to the pre-oral, to the spirit consciousness? Is that...
They want to get to anything other than number four, according to Ms. Cohn. But and I think it would depend on which Taoists you're talking to. My own view And actually echoed by Ms. Cohen as I was reading her, I was having this the same question that you just had, and my own view and her view is that actually what would be ideal is to be able to operate in any of these modalities, in any of these stages of mentation, which is the word she uses, the stages of mentation, as is appropriate. And that, in fact, our obsession with the fourth stage of mentation is the cause of most of our unhappiness in the world. And most of the, not all, but a lot of the strife and unhappiness that we generate.
Separating things into bad, good.
That's right, and then projecting that onto other people so that they're bad or good. I mean, we can certainly see that in operation in our own lives on an individual basis. You know, if someone says the wrong thing to me, you know, I can easily have a thought, an oral thought, that characterizes that person as a result of that response. But in earlier stages of consciousness, you might have instead a situation where like or dislike, emotional response arises, but it is not promulgated and defined and retained in language. One of the things that I'm not quite sure about, but is an interesting thought, is one of the sources she quotes about all this, is that, you know, prior to the oral stage, a Paleolithic person could be in the middle of doing something and forget what they're doing and not have language to remind themselves of that. I mean, that's something that happens to me sometimes, and I have the habit of using language to remind myself. On the other hand, I also have the experience of my body learning something so well that I don't have to think about it at all. I don't have to have any thought mentation happening to efficiently and beautifully accomplish things. So I actually think, you know, the interesting thing about this hypothesis that she's putting forward is that there are these different levels. It's different than what Mr. Harari is pointing to. Everything is just algorithms. It's just these procedures that we use to solve problems, and now we can just rely on increasingly in future he argues we can rely upon non-human algorithm operations to solve our problems and take care of us, and I'm much more enamored of the of this other model. But I want to get to this so if we want to actually follow the Taoist prescription more or less, or at least follow what I suggested earlier, which is the idea that we could enact and operate. Do you need to get something for your
phone? Okay.
To enact and operate from any of those modalities of mentation as is appropriate. How do we do that? Because we have these really strong habits of operating from the mind. So obviously, there's a lot of forms of meditation out there that are certainly one way to do it. But our teacher talked about slack, and so I think I'm gonna. Slack was a funny handle he used to describe something that is also in fourth way literature called the third force. So I'll leave it to Stuart to talk about slack a bit and how we might apply it to having greater capacity to switch modes of mentation.
Well, as I understand slack and the way Robert would describe it, he sometimes equated it to what in the fourth way is called the third force. It's the X factor, or it's the thing that creates spaciousness. And to understand that, if you consider, you know, the way that Rob's been describing the state of our consciousness today, and given the hypothesis he's citing from the book, the suggestion is that this state of consciousness is exacerbated by literacy or a relationship to language and written form. But basically the issue for us is that often our relationship to life is mediated by thoughts, or mediated by concepts, interpretations, perceptions, and these perceptions are charged to varying degrees by emotional identification. So if I have a particularly strong view, a fear about certain circumstances based off of having been bitten by a dog or something like that when I was a child, then I may throughout my life have I see a situation that where a dog's coming, they'll just naturally contract. And similarly, if we have bad experiences with people, particularly when we're raised in family situations, we'll replay those situations whenever a pattern emerges that reminds us or associates back to whatever that situation was. So that's the normal state of mind. It's very congested. It's very stressful because there's very little space for anything other than a inexorable proceeding from one set of associations to another set of associations. And particularly it's congested in the head because these kinds of abstractions are reified in language, and often, to Rob's point, they're like a voice in our heads.
Yeah, Cohen actually even uses the word to describe this level of consciousness as mechanical,
yeah,
which is the same word, of course, that Gurdjieff uses.
Yeah, which is very similar to the prescription that Gurdjieff has about the sort of ordinary operating mode of human consciousness. That operating mode that he describes is like a waking sleep or a waking dream, in which our experience is mediated by projections onto that which we are experiencing. And those projections are basically informed by past experiences, our histories, our memories, and things like that. And so, in that sense, typically in this waking dream, we're not living in the present. We're living in a sort of a past. It's not exactly a past because there's still stimulation of stuff happening in the present, but we're buffering it by virtue of our history and the projective mechanism of the mind. So slack is a way of trying to, or a practice of trying to cut that loose. It's a letting go. You can think of it as a balloon popping. In fact, I remember a workshop once with Robert many, many, many years ago, where one of the exercises in the workshop was to basically keep inflating a balloon until it burst. And it's like, the anticipation and the dread and everything was like building up as this balloon got bigger and bigger and bigger. But then once it burst, it was like this great release, this great shock. And so slack operates in that way. It's kind of like a shock that has the possibility of disrupting the normal mechanical flow of consciousness. And a good example of that we all tend to have access to, you know, this is something Robert would say, and it's very similar to material in the fourth way, but basically you know, this mind or this waking dream functioning will shut down sometimes when there's stress or when there's a shock. So I have like a vivid example. You know, I remember having a near front end collision once with my car, and I wasn't hurt, but it was pretty, my car was totaled, and you know, it was pretty shocking. But what I found was interesting was that I was definitely in a different place in terms of being in a different state of consciousness, because the normal functioning wasn't going on in the same way. But I also noticed that other people were in that, you know, like other people involved in the accident were sort of in that state, and people who would stop by would be sort of in that state. And the only distinction I had was that because I was engaged in a meditative practice, I noticed that my ability to be present in that state where this stuff, where the normal mind wasn't functioning, was different or distinct from what I was noticing with other people in a similar shock state. And the point of all this is that there are ways in which slack can be, you know, induced accidentally, and we can take advantage of that when those shocks happen. And a little trickier is how do you intentionally create slack for yourself? You know, how do you intentionally open yourself to the cessation of the waking dream? You know, how do you break that spell? I mean, there are different ways of approaching that. Meditative practices, I think, have the possibility of breaking that spell, because we can, like with meditation, for instance, begin to turn our attention towards the operation of this dreamlike state, and in doing that, we can begin to see its functioning. And as often described in many forms of meditation, you can also notice that when one thought ends and another and before another thought begins, there's a space. And if we dwell in that space, sometimes we can make that space larger and discover a place where the there's room to breathe, as it were, in terms of experiencing our conscious awareness. Another way of creating slack is to redirect where our consciousness goes. So, you know, the prescription, I used the term congested before, you know, that our, in a sense, our, as the fourth wave people would say, our intellectual center is congested. It's possible to move attention into our bodies. And, you know, this is sometimes, you know, the secret between, you know, the why going for a long run can be so freeing for people. But it's something that we can do very simply even while we're sitting here. You can move your attention into the body. And moving attention into the body creates space. It creates slack. It loosens or releases the tension. Because that's all slack really means. You know, the normal operating mode of the waking dream is incredibly tense. It's incredibly tight, and it's uncomfortable. Slack is the loosening of that. It's the release of that tension. And as you know, as I said, you know, there's techniques for doing that, and sometimes life itself, just by its very nature, provides moments where we find ourselves with space. You know, sometimes these are moments of awe when we're outside and we see a very beautiful sunset or something like that. Sometimes the power of that impression is enough to create a cessation of the dream and to bring us into a more direct relationship with reality.
If you're trying to sleep and can't sleep, you could do progressive relaxation and put your attention on your body as you go through each part of it.
Yeah, that's a great way of, you know, that's just particularly if the reason you can't sleep is because you're thinking up a storm.
Yeah, and your mind is just going like that.
Right. Then putting attention in the body is just feeling your body can be a great way to address that.
And you can do particular places, like the Taoists might recommend putting your attention on your dantian, the center of gravity of your body, a little below your belly button.
You could do a chakra.
You could do chakras. You could do the heart center. By the way, I have your quote about Shin. I found it in that book.
Okay.
So so putting your attention there and letting the sensory input and other input go there has an effect. It doesn't. It's not just some theoretical thing.
I found another method that's sort of ironic, but it seems to work for me. Is that if I'm in that sort of situation where I can't sleep because I have a lot of thoughts, then I'll decide, okay, I'll practice my meditation. And I'll start watching the thoughts for the meditative attention. And generally, that's annoying enough to the mind that it would rather I go to sleep than be subject to that kind of scrutiny. So it's like taking advantage of a situation. But meditation like that is shifting. It's shifting the game because the tension arises when we're identified with our thinking. When there's no space between our awareness and the contents of our dream state or our thinking or our projections.
Yeah. So in the Taoist perspective, as articulated by Kohn, she talks a lot about the different parts of the brain, which of course have different functions, and the prefrontal cortex, this very recent addition to our physiology, is usually associated with this thing that you're describing. I have these thoughts that, and those thoughts, I'm presuming, are discursive, word thoughts. Usually that's the case.
I just read an article, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, in the Wall Street Journal about mantras.
Uh-huh.
And it said everyone should seek to have a mantra because it's been shown that if you repeat this over and over and over, that actually there will be physiological changes for the better in your
mm-hmm.
body.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, just pick. It doesn't have to be
right.
Something that was imparted to you through like TM or something. You can just pick a phrase or a word, and that's your word, and you're repeating this over and over, and it actually has an effect, a beneficial effect.
I
thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a way of cultivating slack as well, because it's pulling your attention out of the identification with the contents of the mind.
Although I will offer the possibility that a mantra that is given by an experienced mantra practitioner or meditation teacher or something like that could actually be better than just something you pick yourself. And some of the reasons for that is that it might, that a different mantra, different words might actually resonate with things beyond just the physiology. I'm not disagreeing at all with the argument of the article. In fact, there are physiological, there's a ton of research that's been reported over the last recent decades, which link how our minds operate in terms of thoughts or no thoughts or whatever with physiological effects throughout the body. So that's all true, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't worthwhile to ask for experienced help in selecting something, but might actually do something more than just add physiological health, but might actually help connect your mind to some more transcendent realm. If that's what you want to do. If you just want to do health, you know the article is right. You could just pick a phrase, presumably, yeah, and
or pick
word.
Something uplifting. You want to pick something like trust or love or loving kindness or something like that. That will at least which point you in the right direction.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that our teacher Robert Ennis used to point to. It's like at the beginning of a meditation practice, we think we know what we want or should want, and yet if we create that goal before we've begun the process of self-examination, then maybe we might find out along the way that it would have been better to choose a different goal, a different direction, a different something. So I'm just throwing that in there as an addition, not to take exception with what you're proposing.
So I think we all want love, not help.
Yeah, but maybe it would be better to not want love, but to give love.
Well, true.
So that's an example of what I'm saying is getting some feedback about it might be helpful.
Yeah, there's a song lyric by Teresa Tuduri, who's been here in the store.
I was just playing one of her CDs the other day.
Oh yeah, and the lyric says, "I always hoped a mighty love would find its way to me, but now I know it's love that I must be."
Yeah, nice lyric.
And it's a very nice lyric, and it certainly resonated with me.
Right. Got it. Thank you.
Now, I did transcendental meditation, and I was given a mantra, which I've never revealed. But I have no idea.
Are you going to do it now for us
no
all?
No way.
Here it is.
You never sorry,
what
is
this?
But it was supposed to have some special meaning for me, and I have used it, but I don't know what it is. I think it's some Sanskrit word, probably. But
I could translate it for you.
I'm not going to do it.
Well, you could probably look it up on Google.
I could look it up myself. I don't even know if I should do that.
I don't know if you should either.
Yeah.
But you might ask the person if you could ask the person who you asked, or another
who's way back in Dallas, Texas.
So do you still use it though?
I do when I meditate. Yeah. I don't just do mindful meditation. I use the mantra.
Yeah. I found it's interesting that there's different forms of meditation and different meditations have different purposes. One that I've been working with lately has been more just to practice holding a state without thinking. And that's challenging. It's kind of like balancing on a big beach ball because thoughts come in, but you know, it's not so much that even in that practice, you know, what I'm trying to attain to is not no thinking as much as no identification with thinking. So if a thought arises, it moves, it just goes out again. But in that process, one of the things that comes up for me that's interesting is that almost all the thoughts that arise for me that are invitations for distraction are arising out of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And the levels of anxiety are subtle in some cases. You know, in some cases it's very obvious. You know, it's like I'm anxious about something I have to do for work or you know, some chore or something like that. Other times it's more subtle, but it's where it's an interesting idea, and the anxiety there is that if I don't grab onto this now, I'm going to lose it. And so it's an interesting reflection, because I in this process, you know, I kind of got this open question of like, is all thought really just anxiety? You know, sort of a crystallized anxiety. and in a way, you know, the kind of state that Rob was describing earlier of what Taoists might attempt to get back to is a way of functioning where that anxiety doesn't have to be present, where there's sort of an immediate knowing of what to do next without a playbill or a buffer or a script playing forth.
I want to jump in here and add another thing, because one thing one might, an inference that one might draw from what we've been saying about slack so far is that you can control it, or you can create the conditions, induce it, yeah. And actually, I think that's a mistaken idea about it. It's like my teacher used to say, you can't go out into a field and draw lightning to yourself, but you can carry a big metal pole and hold on to it in a rainstorm, right? And that's more likely to induce the lightning to strike than not. Obviously, it's a funny metaphor. Yeah, I'll give you another one that you might find more agreeable. And it's what I used at the end of the description of this talk that I wrote, which is the image of water rushing around a boulder in a stream. So why do we find that so beautiful, compelling? Why are we drawn to those places? Why do you see those things on the internet? People take pictures of that. You know, I just saw one the other day of one of my relatives. You know, and we want to look at that. So water moves apparently without effort around obstacles. And that's kind of what we want to do with slack. We want to remove the obstacles. The slack, the third force, the harmonization of yes and no, which is another way to describe the third force or slack, will operate if we don't put obstacles in the way. Or it will, it's like, you know, you could dam up a stream so a big pond, no water flows. Or you could just have these, watch the boulders being, you know, watch the water flow around and over the boulders. So that's another metaphor you can think of. About how to use, how to invite slack into our lives, is to realize that we don't control it. We can channel energies, like we can channel water, but the water's going to win eventually, just as we found out at this dam above Oroville. Not long ago, right? And I just found out they're going to spend $500 million to fix that. $500 million is what it's going to cost. So that water, you know, is pretty darn powerful, and so is potentially the harmonization that we can tune into, as long as we're not pushing it away or damming it up. That's one of the things that the Taoists are very big on, is letting the qi, letting the energy flow. And flow throughout the whole body. So it's not just stuck here in our foreheads, but it's actually moving throughout the entirety of our bodies. And that's an aspect that's a way that we can connect to these earlier aspects of consciousness that I was talking about before, such that Jim told this wonderful story last week about his his Zen teacher's teacher, indicating that this, in the chest, the heart, is the center of both emotion and cognition. So, you don't have to take the Taoist's word for it, or my word for it, but you can explore that by putting your attention there on a regular basis and seeing what happens. Seeing how that might affect your experience of your mental life, your experience of your emotional life, instead of just automatically going there. You know, one of the things I got from my yoga teacher, who's spoken in this, Callan Danielle has spoken in this store many times, is that he would point out to me that I have to turn on this side here. So I would instead of sitting like this, I would sit like this. really, all the time. You know, so you'll notice that my spine is rounded now, as opposed to my chest is out now with my head elevated. But and you know what? You see more and more. And the older people, there's a lot of older people wandering around basketball. I can tell you they're leaning further and further forward. Let me tell you, it's not just a metaphor. It's an actual physical reality in our bodies. In our bodies. And that's, you know, I deeply appreciate that being pointed out to me. You know, I have it as part of my practice now to resist that habit, which is ingrained for 60 years. Yeah.
I want to add to your metaphor of the water flowing around the boulder.
Mm-hmm.
The downstream of the boulder, you've got an eddy, and that's where you find the gold nuggets.
Nice.
So tell us about the gold nuggets that we get from this.
You tell us. You tell us. What do you imagine those gold nuggets? What does that metaphor say to you?
Well, it's escaping from the mind being trapped by anxiety or just trapped into thinking about something at all.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the concept of a mantra or a breathing meditation. It's great stuff, I'm sure, but it's not the same as what Stuart was saying about not thinking at all. It's using one thing to displace another.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that too. What I do when I have anxious thoughts is I try to bring in gratitude instead. And have gratitude thoughts. Oh, this happened, and I'm so glad for it, and so forth. But there again, I'm not really getting to the no thoughts. But all of the different ways are gold nuggets, I guess.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'll just reiterate what I was saying earlier in response, which is that there's nothing wrong with thoughts at all, as long as we are not relying only on that for our responses to life.
Yeah, and I want to point out that when I talk about a practice like trying to have no thoughts, that's a practice. And like any practice, it will reveal certain things, like I was describing about the nature of thought and anxiety. And it will build certain muscles, and it will change one's relationship to the arising of thoughts. But ultimately, the point isn't to not have thoughts arise. It's more to allow the, you know, the thoughts to arise and pass, and not hook us in the way that they normally do, and our relationship to thoughts then, you know, becomes they become tools, or they become data that we can view, but not overly obsess about. And, you know, sometimes it's nice to be able to have the skill where if, you know, thinking starts to get a little bit out of control, if you can turn that off, you know, or at least interrupt that process and remind yourself that you're able to do that, that's a useful result. But I want just to be clear that, you know, practices aren't the end. You know, the practices aren't the end result. They're just tools to help cultivate the conditions to, as Rob was saying, to allow slack to manifest more consistently in our lives. Yep.
To bounce off what Betty was saying, I have much better results with my thoughts and not letting them terrorize me, except when that happens at night when I'm about to fall asleep and something wakes me up,
mm-hmm.
and that starts. I don't have none of those things that work or that I can do to create space work then.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, it just gets this momentum. And I try all these different tricks and things too. I just have to wait.
Yeah.
And try to be as relaxed as possible and just let it happen.
Yeah, well, I think in some respect what you're describing is all we can ever do, and
right.
when we describe a practice like what we call self-observation, which is a mm-hmm. practice of turning attention to the thoughts, as I said, you know, what happens for me in those sorts of situations is I sort of say, okay, well, here's this, you know, I'm not going anywhere, so I have a chance to meditate now,
so you draw back from the
thoughts. Yeah, or I go closer to them in a sense, you know, by putting attention on them, you know, but not the same kind of attention that, you know, there's the kind of unconscious attention where we're just sort of sucked in, and then there's the kind of attention, I guess the way I would describe the attention is to really see the thought for the energetic manifestation that it is.
And
for the energetic manifestation that it is. So, for instance, for example, particularly with these kind of panicky or really intense thoughts like that, locating the energy in the body
mm-hmm.
and saying, you know, like maybe you feel it here in the solar plexus you know, somewhere else, but just putting attention on the whole package. Both the, you know, the feeling in the body, the emotional state, and the construction, you know, whatever the you know, the cognitive representation is, as a totality, is a way for us to engage with the energy, because the one of the reasons that things like that run through us is that they're kind of like energy that's stuck, energy that's not flowing. And so by putting full attention on it, in a sense, it's like attention in the form of adoring. You know, it's like, wow, this is fascinating. What is this? Curiosity.
Stop.
Yeah, exactly. It's curiosity and kind of inviting it to be and to move closer to it. That you might experiment with that, because that I certainly found in my own practice that can shift and actually allow the energy to move, or sometimes it reveals itself of like I realize what the root kernel is, like what the memory is that's being triggered or something like that, and sort of then sometimes things pop.
So another way to approach it, another metaphorical way, is illustrated by something that happened in the store just yesterday. This couple were here, and they had like maybe 5-year-old, 6-year-old boy, and you know they were, and they were. I mean, it's not that they were, you know, bad parents or anything like that, but they sort of were saying no to the kid a little bit, just mildly, and he was getting very hyper. So I just put full attention on him, and he. You know, and that ended up in me making some tea for him and his father, and he by my listening to him, asking him what was happening with him, and you can treat your thoughts the same way, as if they're little children.
Exactly.
That need attention.
Exactly.
That need.
I have one of those at home. I have a kitten, and if I don't pay attention to him, he just starts doing all these bad things, and he escalates, and then I'm like, oh, right. If I just hold him and.
Yeah.
Tell him I love him and pet him for a few minutes, he just
So our thoughts are like that too.
Yeah, so you can try that with thoughts.
Yeah.
That was something that Robert used to describe, because with his own spiritual teacher, he acted as a nanny for his teacher's children at one point, and that was a very powerful teaching experience for him, because he realized that these kids were, if he didn't put attention on them, they were like devils, you know, but as soon as he gave them full attention, they became like little angels.
Yeah, like this kid who was in the story. Right. I mean, he was absolutely charming, and he was, you know, actually for a kid his age, it's like his discrimination with tea and stuff like that were pretty remarkable. But you wouldn't get there unless you put attention on him. And same thing with these thoughts, is seeing them for what they are, which is, you know, just another thing, just another form, just another bit of God.
Right, and as energy formations, they are intelligences.
The problem probably is resisting them because I want to go to sleep. It's that thought that's causing me it's causing tension, anxiety.
That could well be.
Sleep. I won't be able to do what I need to do tomorrow. Yeah. All that comes in.
Right. Yeah. Anxiety.
Yeah. I'm really intrigued with this idea of the four areas of consciousness.
Mentation. Styles of mentation or types of mentation.
So it occurs to me that the eddy, and I'm not sure how to phrase this, but the eddy is to be in that place where you can go to the kind of mentation which is appropriate at that moment.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. I think that's a good way to look at it. I mean, there are other things about these stages as well that are interesting. So, and I wanted to mention this before we concluded. So I mentioned earlier this feature of hunter-gatherer societies as being egalitarian. Mm-hmm. It's not that someone couldn't achieve recognition and status, you know, the great warrior, the great mother, the great whatever role or accomplishment we're talking about. But that would be not what anthropologists call ascribed. That is, it wasn't because their mother or father or family had a certain status, and that inheres in the offspring. But it is earned status. So if we're going to a different eddy, as you to use your language, and the language that was used earlier, then we have the capacity not to exist in this space where we're constantly aware of status, our own relative to other people's, and how we have to treat each other. Especially because of the status that we unconsciously have taken on through our upbringing,
right?
You know, so that's actually kind of interesting to suddenly see someone. You know, you have the habit of having a certain thought about someone. Oh, she's whatever, you know. And then you suddenly, when you're suddenly looking at the, oh my God, that was just a projection. That was my projection onto them. Right? We've all had that experience, right? And so, inviting slack into our lives to enhance the presence of that eddy, if you will, in the energy or flow of the energy in a different direction,
is
part of what I wanted to get at in this talk.
Yeah, one thing that came up for me to circle around with some of our other points of discussion, or something our teacher Robert Innes used to say, and that's that our intellectual center, the fourth way tradition, the Gurdjieff tradition, speaks of the body center, the heart center, and the mental or the intellectual center. The intellectual center is kind of incomplete, or it's not completely functional. It's sort of like a work in progress. to speak to this sort of multi-level gradation of mentation. And in the same way that, you know, when the body is functioning appropriately and is healthy, it doesn't call attention to itself. Right? You function with the body, it has a sort of a...
You don't have to think about, my heart has to beat now.
Yeah, right. You're not above, but if you're sick, you know, you have indigestion, then you're aware of your body. And his point was that the mental center is the same way. The fact that we have all these thoughts cluttering us is because...
And causing us discomfort.
It's indigestion. You know, when the mental center... When the intellectual center is functioning properly, it would be more along the lines of the states that you read about, like flow and things like that, where there's just movement with what is happening, and there's a clarity, a kind of an awakened clarity about what to do next, without this kind of disruptive pause and, you know, kind of clunkiness associated with trying to figure things out.
Yeah, I like the word congestion. I think
that's really good. So it's an interesting...
It resonates for me with my allergy response. Yeah.
I've always found that kind of a useful model from Robert, which is, you know, just to remind myself that, oh yeah, if I'm thinking, then it's probably indigestion. If I'm thinking mechanically, you know, there's a difference. Like sometimes when we have directed thought, or we kind of intend thinking, or we're trying to create something, maybe we're writing and things like that. But even then, I'd say that often when we kind of hit the mark, things emerge without us having to formulate.
Well, it's possible that I hadn't thought of this before until just this moment that when you said this, that you know, Robert used to make the assertion that if the prefrontal cortex, if the thinking mind is operating efficiently, you don't have the experience of the voice in your head, because the voice you're hearing someone speak to you, it is received by a part of the mind that doesn't have to repeat it like an old telephone answering machine. That's a metaphor that he used a lot, was what we call the mind is like a telephone answering machine. And the problem is we're not paying attention to our lives, and our mind, attempting to respond and allow an effective response to life, records things. And that's what we're hearing in our heads, is the recorded messages that we did not receive in the part of the mind that doesn't need to keep repeating them. Okay.
Which is again why paying attention to the thoughts in the way that you pay attention to children that are acting out allows that completion of that circuit.
Right.
So ultimately, by giving full attention to the thought, the communication is complete, and that particular thought has served its purpose, and practice is often about giving our interior space that kind of attention until enough thoughts have been received in the parts of our existence that don't need to repeat them, that suddenly there's more space.
So I'll just mention as we conclude here that, you know, credit where it's due, the concept of slack was one that Robert ripped off from a group called the Church of the Subgenius.
Yes! I was hoping you'd mention the Church of the Subgenius.
Yes. Yes. Whose patron saint was Bob.
Bob. Yeah, it was, I don't know if they're still around now, but the Church of the Subgenius.
Yeah, so there's like this grainy 50s father type.
Right, with a pipe.
Yeah, with a pipe. With a pipe, and that was Bob. That was Bob, the patron saint of the Church of the Subgenius.
You have to Google it.
It's trippy. It's this trippy. Yeah, it's worth doing.
Regular radio show.
It was a radio show. I didn't know.
Yeah,
that
it was on the KPFA for a long time.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's great. I'll have to look that up.
Weird. We're away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's and the point is partly useful here because in retrospect, that was a period when there was a lot there was more slack for people to explore different alternatives in at the edges of culture, and it seems to me that that's happening in different ways now, but that was one way that was happening then, and Robert was able to link it to this third force concept, so that we get a flavor of something that doesn't just sound goody two shoes. Slack doesn't sound goody two shoes. Maybe that's too old a phrase for someone Odin's age. I don't know. You get it? No, I don't know. I have to ask these days. You know, I'm old enough now that I sometimes have to ask. So anyway.
Ruby. What's the goody two shoes version of Slack?
Yeah, the goody two shoes is I must harmonize my yes and no. I'm obligated to do it. That would be the goody two shoes.
Gotcha.
That's the instead of freedom and space, it's yet another layer of obligation.
More anxiety.
A lot of that.
A lot of that in Sebastopol.
It's in that subculture. It's there.
Tell me about it. Tell me about it.
It's all good.
It's all good. It's all good. Well, on that note, it's all good.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Sometimes a good situation is just a good situation.
Exactly. Exactly.
That was nice thing to take away from that, wasn't it? Yeah. When you were looking at that beautiful scene.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about it was my teacher snuck up behind me. Yeah. I didn't hear him coming. And then he, you know, kind of leans like over and says, sometimes a good situation is a good situation.
I love that story.
Yeah. Beautiful.